Welcome to a special roundtable discussion on the media's impact on the 2012 presidential race. This roundtable was recorded at the Lone Star Legislative Summit on Thursday, February 16th on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. The Lone Star Legislative Summit was produced by the Nacogdoches County Chamber of Commerce in cooperation with Stephen F. Austin State University and was presented by Norbord. Kate Archer Kent, News Director for Red River Radio, serves as our moderator.
From the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas, you're listening to a special roundtable discussion as part of the fourth Lone Star Legislative Summit. The topic we're exploring this hour is the media's impact on this year's presidential race. I'm Kate Archer Kent, news producer for Red River Radio and the moderator for this discussion. Joining me at the table are Kenny Bowles, the news director for KLTV and KTR-TV in East Texas. Kenny has worked more than 40 years in broadcast news, starting at age 17, the tender age of 17, at KTRE in Lufkin. His tenure in broadcast news has included field producing in the Middle East and Central America for ABC News and covering the presidential campaigns of Gerald Ford, John Glenn, Gary Hart, and Jesse Jackson. Also with us is Dr. Ken Collier, an associate professor of political science here at Stephen F. Austin State University. Ken holds a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, and he's written extensively on the presidency, including the book Between the Branches, the White House Office of Legislative Affairs, and a new book on presidential speech writing. We're also joined by Dr. George Edwards, a political science professor at Texas A&M University. He also holds the Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies. He's authored dozens of articles and has written or edited 25 books on American politics and public policy making. He's also editor of Presidential Studies Quarterly and general editor of the Oxford Handbook of American Politics series. And our fourth panelist is Patty Kilday Hart, Metro columnist at the Houston Chronicle. She's worked as a journalist in four Texas cities and has written about Texas politics for about 20 years. She's contributed to the Texas Monthly's story titled 10 Best, 10 Worst Legislators since 1989, and she is a journalism graduate of the University of Texas at Austin. Panelists, to open this discussion, I'd like to have each of you take a minute or so to provide your synopsis view of how the media are approaching the coverage of the 2012 presidential race, and please share your observations on how the race is being packaged for us consumers of news. And Patty, we'll begin with you.
I was hoping you wouldn't start with me, but I'll jump in. I wanted to talk a little bit about the challenge that it's meant for Texas journalists, especially those of us who have covered the Rick Perry administration in Austin. We, have covered him since he stepped into the governor's role in 2000, and have written numerous stories that were unknown to the rest of the country. And so the special challenge, I think, for the Texas media, and not just a challenge, but a responsibility, is to tell that story again to the rest of the country. Now that our governor was in the race, we had the expertise and the knowledge to dive deep into his background and his resume, his achievements and lack of as governor. And I think it presented a challenge because most of the stories we had told over and over again. So we tried to repackage them, find some new angles, and present these stories that were familiar to all of us. The tales of crony capitalism come to mind. And it was always interesting to pick up your New York Times and find a story on the front page with sort of a breathless, here's some new things about Texas Month, about Rick Perry, about Texas Governor Rick Perry, that were very, very familiar to all of us who've covered him in Texas.
So. And Kenny?
First of all, it's an honor to be here, share the stage with such a prestigious group. And thank you for allowing me to give the perspective from a profession that I love so much and am often so embarrassed to say I'm a part of. In my humble opinion, the media coverage of the presidential campaign is embarrassingly shallow and irrelevant. It's very much a circus-like atmosphere that's focusing on the drama and the personalities with a total lack of substance. And I think it's disgraceful, and I think it's a disservice to the American people. I think it reinforces two very important factors that many members of the mainstream media continue to deny and ignore. And number one, most people, most news consumers, no longer rely on the mainstream media as their primary source of news and information. There is an information revolution that's been going on for a few years that many people in the media simply haven't grasped yet. And number two, many people, if not most, don't consider that the mainstream media is going to give them impartial, unbiased information. They believe that there is a significant bias, and I'm afraid to say that this presidential campaign has done nothing but reinforce the fact that the national mainstream media does have their thumb on the scales and are trying to sway your opinion toward one candidate or another. You know, there's a reason that Jon Stewart is the most trusted newsman in America. And that is because he exposes the media and political circus for what it is. And he holds these public figures and these media personalities accountable for what they say and do. Nobody else does that. And it's a shame. But that's where we are.
And Dr. Collier.
Well, picking up on what Kenny Bowles said, it's a really exciting time to teach this subject. As a faculty member, I'm charged with being in between the students and what's going on. And often, we teach the same thing we've been teaching for a long time, but there really is a new media out there, and it really is shaping the way the campaign is conducted. And I think, you know, you're right that in some ways the mainstream media hasn't figured out these changes. And I think another thing that's true is a lot of the campaigns haven't figured out the changes yet. And what you're seeing is a lot of them stumbling from day to day, not really understanding the way people are using media and how much better they can do it and how much more cheaply they can do some things that they're used to throwing money at. And I think that one of the things you'll see is over the next couple election cycles, you'll see campaigns starting to figure out that this new media landscape means that they can escape some of this circus. That is, yes, there's a circus atmosphere out there in the media, and if you will work creatively to get around it, you can.
And Dr. George Edwards.
The media typically, and it's for a long time, focuses on the horse race. Who's ahead? Who's behind? We like stories of the winners and losers and outcomes and stakes, and so it's quite natural, and there's conflict, and so the focus is on that kind of conflict. This is, but I think also the media is passive. And that, by that I mean, and I'm talking about the national media covering national candidates. By that I mean it's pretty much a reaction to what the candidates do. So I actually printed out, there's a project for excellence in journalism that provides us weekly updates of what percentage of the stories about the campaign include which candidate, so who's getting press time, and the tone of that press time. And it's quite interesting if you look at it, and I'll give this to anyone who wants it, you see that the candidates who get the most press time are the candidates are doing better. And when a candidate unexpectedly does well, they get a lot more press time. And if they crash and burn, well, the press time goes down. Pretty much what you'd expect. So the candidates in many ways are still setting the agenda. It's interesting about the tone. The media naturally is interested, and are people up to the job, and they particularly like, are you contradicting yourself? Are you a hypocrite? Those kinds of things. Partly because I think they think that the audience is quite interested in that. Now, a lot of the tone in asking such questions is inevitably negative. But it's interesting that it doesn't seem to favor one particular ideology or another. For example, just looking at the tone here, basically Romney has a little bit more negative than positive. Rick Santorum, who would probably not be the media darling, at least at first glance, has more positive than negative. Sorry.
Oh. I'm not sure I'm the expert.
Oh, good. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Gingrich was about even, and just recently he's got negative. The most positive coverage is for Ron Paul, who in one way is better or worse or whatever, doesn't really matter, but is certainly apart from the other candidates. He is by far the most positive coverage in the media, and I think the explanation for that is he's the most consistent. Right or wrong, he's the most consistent. So he gets positive coverage. And the person who's got the most negative coverage is Barack Obama when it comes to campaign stories. So I think that we shouldn't really be surprised about this because it's pretty much a reflection of what other candidates are saying about other candidates, and so that gets covered. I agree that it would be much better in a perfect world if we had much more discussion about what are your health care plans? Okay, you don't like this one? What do you got? What do you got for us? And then let's have really complex discussions, in-depth discussions about your solutions to the problems. But there's two difficulties. That one, not everybody has much in the way of a plan. Some people's plan is to have no plan. And second, once you say it, it's old news. And the news is about new. And so they can't say, for the 47th day in a row, Rick Santorum has taken exactly the same stand on issue X. So we inevitably get a lot of time on the horse race or the circuses.
Panelists, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. I can safely say that I'm not tweeting during this panel discussion or updating my Facebook status. But I bet some in the audience are. And so I'm wondering, what is the role of social media in the presidential election coverage? And anyone can feel free to offer up their viewpoint.
Okay, first of all, Kate is not tweeting this important event.
I'll jump in. The first thing that comes to mind is the media has a natural news cycle. And, you know, if something's 8 hours old, it's dead. Social media changes that because it can keep alive a story and drive it, keep it going for several days. And that's a huge factor. It can give a story legs that wouldn't normally have legs. The other thing, and this isn't exactly social media, but a little bit, maybe new media, it's become a phenomenon that the ads that the campaigns produce, that the professionally produced television ads that campaigns of yesteryear would have appeared only in Iowa. Well, they're on everybody's Facebook page, they're on YouTube, and they're viewed, they have such a bigger audience that way that in previous campaigns you wouldn't have seen. And I think that's a remarkable phenomenon that's, I think, new to this campaign, you know, and so you'll have discussions on late night television or in Facebook forums about Rick Perry's strong ad that was so controversial, whereas in previous campaigns, only the voters of Iowa would have seen that ad.
I think this plays into what Dr. Collier was referring to when he said the campaigns are trying to figure out how to adapt to this incredible revolutionary change in the way consumers get news and information. What I see social media being used right now in the presidential level is as a marketing tool, both for the media and for the candidates themselves. And I'm sorry, I think the end result initially is that it's dumbing down the message because you simply can't put a lot of profound thoughts into 140 characters. And I think what they're doing is they're just communicating the essential superficial message to their followers that is more the Republican or the Democratic thought for the day, the storyline for the day. And they're also using social media, these multi-platforms, as we call it, the internet, mobile, Twitter, Facebook. They're also using it to appear more like a human being, you know, to get more personal, to get more, down more, a little more on the one-on-one level with their fans and their potential followers. But, you know, it's like Dr. Collier says, they're going to continue to manipulate it and try to figure out how to use it to go around the media. And that, I think, is probably the most important avenue and aspect of the emergence of social media, is that it is yet another tool for political candidates to avoid and evade the scrutiny of good media and good journalists and speak directly to the voters.
I have to admit, I don't tweet, but I do have data, which is what I do. I do data. And it's interesting to me that there's actually been not much volume until just recently, and it's particularly in Romney. There's been lots of volume for Romney, and the Obama campaign has had lots of volume. However, what is particularly interesting to me, given what we might think that these would all be going from the candidate to the public, and they would therefore be positive, because candidates rarely say negative things about themselves. But when we look at the tone of the tweets, it turns out that they're often overwhelmingly negative. On Romney, 50% are negative, 20% are positive. That's kind of interesting. On Santorum, it's a smaller range, but still negative. Gingrich, too. Paul has been very, very positive, and there's been a big difference, positive. And Obama, again, very much negative. So somebody else is doing some tweeting besides the campaigns, and it's adding an additional negative component to the campaign.
Yeah, if I could up on some of these, it's interesting because one of the things I do often is go to campaign seminars where they train campaign consultants, or where they go to swap tips or the latest product. And one of the first things the consultants say is, if you have a candidate and they have a cell phone or a BlackBerry or something, take it away from them. For God's sakes, do not let them talk to the voters on that, because they're going to do some late night tweet or something that's going to embarrass them. So, and what you get is this very disturbing message, which is, whatever you do, do not let the candidate express himself sincerely to the voter. which is really what we've had for generations in America. Just before, we put it on television, we put it on radio, we did it in the newspaper. And so the campaigns are beginning to adapt. But it's not always in a good way. Now, there are some good things. I think maybe when you were covering, Jesse Jackson in Iowa, he could probably go there and say, you know what, I'm going to get you guys some subsidies for this and that, and the rest of us never would have known. And now, Rick Perry gone there and promised a bunch of stuff, I would have known the next day. And there is a level of transparency that, when done correctly, can create a lot of opportunity in politics for the right kind of decisions. But at the same time, the campaigns are going to use these in a very narrow way. So, I think the short answer to your question is, what impact is this going to have? I think it's going to have a huge impact. It's just going to be very hard to sort out, because a little bit will be through Twitter, a little bit through Facebook, a little bit through YouTube, 8 million views of Rick Perry's strong video. A lot of things are going on. There's so many messages going out, and it really changes the strategy of the campaign.
Let's talk a little bit about polarization. Sometimes you can't really lump all media into one boat. Of course, you might need to differentiate here between like a legacy media outlet, New York Times, versus other media outlets. But if you can kind of probe a little bit, are media organizations contributing to polarization? Do you expect to see more of this sort of pigeonholing and kind of compartmentalizing, if you will, in the fall campaign? And anyone can take that question.
I can jump in very quickly, because I think about this a lot, especially about the how much the media creates conflict. I think about that when I'm watching Real Housewives of Orange County. And it strikes me that, the media doesn't create conflict so much as it rewards our thirst for it. I mean, we really love that so much that people will, apparently in large numbers, tune in to watch, women in Southern California fight over whatever it is. I can't say I watch it enough to be an expert on it. But you pick up the basic theme very quickly for those who haven't seen it. There's a lot of conflict over not very much. And I think that this Republican field has been a great opportunity for that. Because I think one of the weaknesses of this Republican field is they're all racing for the same spot on the spectrum. And that, unfortunately, creates the opportunity. Well, let's talk about other things. The debate isn't what conservatism should be. They're all gravitating towards the same point and denying to the others the true conservative, and that creates this almost catfight atmosphere that's not very appealing and drowns out the real discussion of what the issues are or should be.
I'll add something. I think some of the media contributes to polarization. When we had when cable came and the internet, and so the idea was everyone will be so well informed now, and be all this information, and you'll have all this cross-cutting information, and this will be fantastic. What actually happened is that people find an outlet with which they agree. And so they get constant reinforcement. Now, that's not helpful. Now, that's not good for a democracy. That's bad. And if you have Fox on one hand and MSNBC on the other hand, and the more people rely on outlets like that or their favorite blogs, which tend to be one side or the other, The more they get reinforced, the more they're told regularly that the other side is not just wrong-headed about a particular policy, but actually trying to undermine America and probably in league with the devil, that is not very helpful. And that just encourages polarization. And as you probably know, we have the most polarized public, the most polarized Congress, and we've had since the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And that makes it very, very difficult to accomplish anything. We all want something. We all are against gridlock. But these kinds of forces encourage gridlock and discourage compromise, because you can't compromise with the devil.
Patty Hart?
I'd like to add to that. I completely agree with everything you just said. And I think it starts with, you mentioned legacy media, and I think the where you really find this sort of really negative impact on politics is the new outlets that are filling a 24-hour news cycle. If you are going to keep driving your audience and hang on to your audience, you know, from all hours of the day, you've got to have shout fests. And so, you know, you go to one station or another to watch people screaming at each other without illuminating anything of the message. It's much like Housewives of whatever. You're there to watch people have a cat fight, not really talk about politics, and it's a real dumbing down, I think. I'm a dinosaur here. I work for a newspaper. You know, who picks up a newspaper anymore? But in my way of thinking, that's where you're going to get the in-depth kind of coverage about issues and about real substantive stories about someone's background and character. You're not going to find that on a station where people are just trying to drive their numbers.
And the larger you move up the media chain, the more you'll find that numbers are at the very essence of their editorial decisions and the approach that they take in disseminating the information they have. One of the reasons that it's become so polarizing is because the news media itself has become polarized. They have become advocates for a particular point of view. And they do it, and many do it under the guise of journalism. And we can only hope that voters continue to educate themselves and continue to show some personal responsibility to seek out the facts, the real facts. Lewis Black does this whole thing about, you know, the Republicans have their set of facts on an issue and the Democrats have their set of facts on an issue, and they don't agree in any way, shape, manner, or form. Where do you get the fact facts? There can only be one set of fact facts. And I think that's what voters are struggling to find today. Where can you look for the fact facts? Because unfortunately, so many of the national media have, you take the broadcast cable networks, for example, you know, they use celebrity commentators on their shows, and it taints everything that that organization does in its coverage, because the perception is going to be there, if not the very action itself. The perception is going to be there that Fox is going to give you the conservative bent and the conservative point of view, and that MSNBC and NBC are going to give you the liberal point of view. You know, they've created a football game. We've got the conservative Cowboys versus the liberal Indians. And we've got sports commentators with the mindless dribble that they shell out during a football game now covering politics. And it's a sad situation that we're in. But, yes, the polarization is very much there and very prominent.
I'd like to add just one thing. The numbers do drive it. And who are the numbers? It's us. I would make a recommendation for the NewsHour on PBS. It's the best news show on TV, in my opinion. Okay, and I think it's extremely, extremely neutral. They have always in-depth discussions and have somebody from each side. Some articulate, intelligent, knowledgeable person from each side, whatever the issue may be. Well, we know about the numbers, and the numbers, you know, they're non-existent, but it's a very tiny percentage of the public who chooses to watch the NewsHour or any other show that's like that. So it's not just that the media refuses to provide what we need, it's that we don't demand what we need.
Can I say one thing?
Go ahead.
Positive? I know that doesn't fit with the media storyline here. But one of the things that's interesting, that I see studying elections historically is that media in this country began largely as a partisan enterprise. And, you know, the partisan media of the early, Thomas Jefferson was basically paying government employees so many words.
Philip Freneau.
Yeah, Freneau to publish a publication that criticized the Federalists. And so in some ways we have kind of devolved to where we began. And the positive side of that is this has always been with us. I mean, it may be very bad right now, but we're not the generation that invented partisan media. We've just rediscovered it and perhaps perfected it using the internet.
You know, I will add one more thing to that. I made that comment to a former conservative Democrat congressman from Texas when we were talking about the cable news and how awful and mean it was. And I was reading, I think, a biography of John Adams and was surprised at how virulent some of the discourse was back then. And he said, and I thought this was important, yes, but it's not in every working man and woman's ear mm-hmm. all day long. And that is a real difference. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you have people listening to Rush Limbaugh in the carpool line, you know, it's a very different thing that it's constant. It's a constant drip, drip, drip of virulent discourse.
Well, candidates, panelists, you're going to change job descriptions here for a moment. Turning to campaign strategies, how do you think the presidential candidates should go about campaigning in Texas and neighboring Louisiana?
I think they should campaign, and they won't.
Yeah.
What is going to happen is that none of the presidential candidates will come to Texas after the convention. You won't see them unless they pop in to a city to raise some money and talk to, you know, 75 people and leave. And it's probably going to be true in Louisiana as well. And that's one of the problems of the Electoral College is it discourages candidates from visiting states, even big states like Texas, where we can predict the outcome pretty well now. So that would be, I think, the major point here. They're not going to campaign.
Well, Texas is insignificant in the grand scheme of life and living in the presidential campaign right now. I mean, we're looking at, what, a May 29th primary?
Right.
Maybe. We can't get our act together, and unfortunately, we've fallen in and are part of a system that's so flawed that, you know, Iowa, will, I think a later question covers this, but Iowa and New Hampshire and a handful of states literally choose what candidates we're going to get to consider. You know, the filter happens too soon. We don't have a choice by the time it gets to Texas. So if the candidates did come, they should leave the national media behind, and they should get down on the local level, and they should talk to local reporters and local journalists who don't bring a biased approach to their reporting and would ask some hard questions about what these candidates stand for and what they would do to help the people who live in those communities and to address some of the critical issues that face our government. But like the doctor said, it ain't going to happen.
If the issue is what would best serve that campaign, I think it was touched on earlier in our conversation when we talked about how positive the media reporting on Ron Paul has been. It's not because the media is in love with Ron Paul. It's that he's consistent. And there's something very admirable about that and very absent from the conversation that we have with our candidates. So if I was giving advice to any candidate, I would say make sure your message is consistent because the people in Nacogdoches are going to know what you said in Iowa.
And I think the polls reflect the fact that the voters, they don't, in my humble opinion, they don't necessarily want Ron Paul to be president. Good Lord, he's out there on a limb on a few things, folks. But he's consistent, and he's the anti-candidate. You know, it's sort of a protest vote. You know, these other yahoos are just not acceptable. So, you know, we've seen it happen in past election campaigns. And that's just what I think.
I do think there's a constraint. I mean, let's say that it gets to, I mean, that Texas is in play or talking about campaigning in Louisiana. You know, how do you break through? And there is this almost fatalism among candidates sometimes that the narrative coming out of the media is going to be the narrative coming out of the media. We can't impact that. But, you know, we can train puppies to, you know, not go to the bathroom inside the house. Surely we can train the media to do a few things that are constructive. And I think that, you know, again, I think the current crop of candidates has allowed themselves to fall into a narrative in the campaign that gave the media opportunity to go into some of these other areas and start talking about things that aren't that important. And as you cite, Ron Paul has given a message in the campaign that really does drive the reporters to ask certain questions. I think sometimes the questions, you know, are about the doubts they have about those policies, but they're about those policies. And I do think that if the candidates were willing to be more ambitious with some of their issue stands, to spend more time spelling it out, they can get the media to cover these stories. Again, as George has suggested, some of it is it has to go back to us, because we do drive this process. And you know, I remember seeing Gary Hart campaigning in Austin when he was running for president, when he in a fit of desperation hauled out that 100-page plan for America, and it got some attention for a while because there was something that the media could chew on, kind of had to chew on. But I also sat in the audience and watched a lot of people in the audience just lose interest after the healthcare discussion went past a couple of minutes. And so some of the training we have to do is ourselves and get ourselves to invest in an argument that it goes beyond what's covered. You know, the media tries to fill a lot of time, and we make it too easy for them to focus on those shouting matches that, again, look more like professional wrestling than traditional American politics.
So a lightning round question here. Who will win in Texas?
Among the Republican candidates?
Yeah, let's do that. Right.
I think Santorum in Texas, and I think Obama will win the election.
But not necessarily King of Texas, right?
He's not going to win Texas. Santorum will win Texas, but he won't win the election, in my humble opinion.
Anyone else like to look into their crystal ball?
I'll go with Santorum. I think that message is going to resonate with Texas conservatives. They, on one hand, they have doubts about Romney, given, you know, his variations on his theme. And Gingrich, in some ways, is just not the kind of candidate that's attractive to them. And I think Gingrich, in a way, is in a disadvantage in the South, because I think a lot of us grew up watching Southern candidates. And we know the difference between a really good Southern candidate and a not-so-good Southern candidate. And I don't think Gingrich connects that well. Gingrich is from Georgia, but he's also, you know, used to be a professor. And as much as some of us think that's a good career choice, I know there's a lot of you got doubts about what we're up to. And you know, there are just times when he comes across as a professor. He likes to flirt with ideas and
likes to flirt with a lot of things.
Yes.
Yeah.
I said that up great. You owe me one.
I do.
Let's leave it at that.
And I think that's a killer in Texas. They're not going to go for it. But I have to tell you, Sarah Palin's hanging back there. She's hoping for a gridlock. She's hoping for a deadlock at the convention. She's hoping it won't fall either way. You know, she's praying for a dead heat with two or three, preferably three candidates. And that's exactly what she's working on now. You wonder why you haven't heard from her. You wonder why she hasn't been in the news lately. I'm telling you, that's exactly what she is trying to pull off.
I got a prediction on that. If it comes to a deadlock convention, Palin doesn't win. I got to say, it's nothing against Palin. It's just her organization, I don't think, is as good in those kind of settings. You know, I think in that kind of setting, a Romney or a Gingrich, somebody who's used to working those networks, maybe does better.
Dr. Edwards?
I don't really have anything to add to that.
I'm going to go in a completely different direction, and it's influenced by someone I heard speak earlier this week. Former Secretary of State James Baker made the prediction at a luncheon I went to that Romney would be the nominee, and he bases it on just historically the Republican Party, both parties really, flirt with people on the fringe. And then when it's time to actually, you know, it's like, who do you date and who do you marry? You want to go back to someone who's a little bit more reliable at the end of the day. And that's what he predicts for the Republican Party. And as far as whether it's Obama or Romney in the fall, it's all about unemployment figure. That's the deciding factor.
I'm curious, did he predict that Romney would win Texas in the presidential election?
He just simply said he would be the party's nominee.
Because I have to tell you, I think if Romney were on the Republican ticket, he'd lose Texas.
Really?
Yes,
that's
in my humble opinion.
That's interesting.
Yes, I don't. I think the health care issue is a major factor. I think the Mormon issue is a major factor. I mean, I'm not saying that it's right. I don't believe in that kind of bias at all. But it is a factor among many voters.
I'd like to pick your brain a little bit on super PAC spending and that whole world of finance going on behind the scenes in these campaigns, and such interesting stories coming out about these super PACs and the ads that we hear and see on YouTube. And can we talk a little bit about the impact of super PAC spending, Kenny?
I gave $5 to Stephen Colbert's super PAC.
Me too.
I had to.
And I bought some of the ice cream.
Yeah.
Full disclosure.
And the big I have to tell you, I don't know if you watch Stewart and Colbert on a regular basis. I do. I'm big fans because, as I said, I think they expose this ridiculous circus for what it is. And I have a 29 and 21 year old sons who are both big fans as well. And I have to tell you, that's where they get most of their news and information, or it sends them off in a direction to a website or to chase down exactly what happened, to go to YouTube and look at a clip in its entirety. And it has been an amazing education for them on this whole super PAC issue and the dramatic impact that it's having on the campaigns and the whole issue that corporations are people too, and the media are corporations as well. Keep that in mind. It's going to be one of the most dramatic changes and influences that we've seen on an election.
I'm really glad you brought it up, because I think it's going to be probably have more impact than anything we've talked about so far. Forget Fox News and MSNBC and the Houston Chronicle and the New York Times. These super PACs have the ability to drown out that message with very specific, targeted messages that no candidate will ever survive if they become the target.
Hmm.
So I think who wins the super PAC fundraising may be the best way to predict who's going to be the next president of the United States.
I agree with most of what's just been said, and it certainly contributes. It's allowed some candidates like Romney to just flood markets with negative advertising. And surely candidates have been criticizing each other throughout the entire history of the United States. So it's not that that's wrong, but when there's such a large percentage is negative and there's so much of it, you're way over a threshold, it really does turn people off. I don't think this is very helpful for turnout, for voter participation, or voter education. Moreover, I think there's another issue here, and I'm not the first one to raise it, and that is that a few people can have an awful lot of influence. If you've got 200 people providing $18 million or whatever, and that is one example, I mean, that is a lot of power for a very few people. And I think it's worth wondering, is that really the best way for democracy to work?
Well, I just feel obligated to disagree at some point, so I'm going to start now. Let me start by saying Colbert's demonstration of the functioning of super PACs is as effective a presentation of campaign finance as I've ever seen. I mean, it's if you watch that segment, because he brought on the guy who had been John McCain's campaign finance lawyer, and they walked through, you know, almost as cabaret or something, the steps they went through to make this legal. It's a wonderful illustration. It's a great teaching tool. And so I highly recommend Colbert. And I think that illustrates, you know, how far off the reservation we are in terms of how far we are from what we expect normal politics to be. And I don't mean to dismiss these $10 million donors. I think those $10 million donors will have much more impact on the election than I will. But I also think that there will be a somewhat limited impact by this because, you know, if I tell you, for example, those of you who are Romney fans or not, that Romney put his dog on top of his car during a family trip, if I tell you that several times, a lot of you are going to say, yeah, I've heard that before, right? And at some point, repetition of these messages doesn't buy you that much. And I do think that these super PACs will have an impact, but I also think that these are in part organizations that are best at fleecing large donors, because these people get a commission off their media buys and everything else. And if I can get George to give me $5 million to put some ads on the air, yeah, I can make some money off that, and I can start buying some art for my walls instead of George buying all the good art. So I often think that we think so much of these ads that we have to be careful and step back and realize that a lot of this money is going to be wasted. And if you talk to people in advertising, sometimes they'll tell you, you know, some of these ads just don't work. And on some of these messages, I think we're going to have heard these attacks so often that'll mute their attack. Now, I think the point that George raises is very important. That is, the negativity drives people away from the polls. I think when elections are this nasty, you don't want any part of it. I mean, you know, you go in and vote, then you want to wash your hands, right? I mean, it's just that kind of election sometimes. And I do worry that these negative campaigns on both sides will drive independents out. And that will leave the people on the left and the right to decide the election. And I think that anything that disenfranchises the independents, people in the middle, is problematic.
And so in this discussion, we've heard a lot about the word negativity. And panelists, is the political climate discouraging good candidates from running?
Who would want to? My wife and I were talking about this as I was preparing for this event, excuse me. And, you know, we were just going over the fact that the most talented people and the people who could probably have the greatest impact and who have the most experience in solving these kinds of problems, people with strong business backgrounds, et cetera, most of them are simply not going to put themselves through the media meat grinder in those early days in Iowa and New Hampshire and expose their family to that kind of scrutiny and circus. It just doesn't make sense for a lot of smart people. I don't think we get the best candidates, and I think most voters believe that the people who are running simply want to be president, that they're not really doing it in the best interest of the country, or they truly want to change things, or they want to have an impact, a lasting impact on our future and the future of our children. They just want power. It's like most candidates we see, as soon as they're elected, they start running for re-election again. You know, there really isn't much thought to what they do. Just don't make any mistakes. Don't screw up. I don't believe the best and the brightest are interested at all in the flawed political process that we currently have.
I agree that certainly the process, which is very long to begin with, discourages many candidates. But I think it also discourages candidates from being sensible, the candidates they do have, and discourages people from compromising. I'll just give you one example. Lindsey Graham is a Republican senator from South Carolina, and in my opinion, he's a good senator. Not because I agree with everything he says, and I would agree with not, there would be no such person, but he tries to actually work out through complex problems. So he worked with the Democrats, Republicans and Democrats, on climate change, on immigration, I mean, complex policies. And what happens in the current political climate is that his own party's county committees, executive committees, pass resolutions condemning him. You can go on the web and look these up, condemn him for all kinds of horrible things, but essentially condemning him for trying to work out compromises so that we could actually do something. Independent of a particular compromise, it's the fact that he's trying to work out a compromise. So the process and the polarized process discourages people like that, which is exactly the kind of person that we actually need if we want to actually get anything done.
I'm really glad you brought that up because we've talked a lot today blaming the media for the negativity in the political realm. And I think more than anything, redistricting has made our Congress very, very extreme, which creates a kind of situation where a Lindsey Graham isn't seen as a statesman, he's seen as a sellout. Because of the primary process and because of redistricting, redistricting creates safe Republican seats and safe Democratic seats. And that means that nobody who's kind of in the middle is going to be elected to either of those kinds of districts. So you get these extremes and you get people who will criticize Lindsey Graham. And then I'm going to make one plug for negative articles in the press, and I'll give you an example. Last time around, I kind of thought John Edwards was a cool guy. And then the National Enquirer opened my eyes. And I remember when I first heard that story, I was like, oh, please, the National Enquirer is chasing John Edwards through a basement of a hotel. This has got to be just crazy talk. Well, you know what, guys? Sometimes those stories need to be told. The Herman Cain story needed to be told. People do need to know about Calista and Newt and how that relationship came about. Especially if you're a stalwart Republican, you need to know that if you want the strongest candidate to take on Barack Obama. So I just wanted to put in a little pitch for why sometimes negative stories are useful.
I think that's a pitch for the fact that these folks need to have some character as well.
Yeah.
And too often, you know, the bottom line for me is when I look at the role of the media in politics, I don't know what the answer is as far as how we achieve this goal. But we must communicate to people and inspire them to take individual responsibility for getting the facts and getting the correct information and not falling prey to all of this emotional-driven, theatrical drama, Housewives of Orange County, you know, BS, and to become responsible U.S. citizens. I mean, I know that sounds so trite, but it's so true. I mean, what we've let the government do is become a reflection of our worst habits. They've spent too much money. They can't pay their bills, which unfortunately reflects the plight of many Americans who are deeply in credit card debt and can't balance their checkbooks. And it's interesting, again, I was having a discussion with some of the other journalists, that do you think anybody really wants to elect a candidate who will fix it? Because if they fix it, we're the ones who are going to have to pay for it. I think there's an interesting complex, doctors, help me here, contradiction, because we don't want our taxes raised. We don't want to lose our entitlements. I'm 57. I don't want to see Social Security go away. I worked really hard for that. But yet there are some cold, hard realities to what the government has to do in order to fix the problems, and that is that they're going to have to raise taxes. They're going to have to cut entitlements. Our plight is not much different than the European countries are facing. And I said, what we've got to do is, as a media, and I don't know how we do it, but we've got to inspire people to want to be responsible citizens. And if you've got any ideas on that, let me know.
Well, let me pick up on that and say something about character. I think that we had to define that very carefully, and I don't think you implied this at all, but I mean, part of character involves having flaws and transcending them. I mean, one of my favorite characters to talk about in all of Texas politics is Sam Houston, who went through a lot of marriages and a lot of alcohol before he became, you know, the founder, one of the founders of Texas, right? I mean, there was a man with great flaws. George W. Bush had character. Now, some of that came from his flaws. And I think that we need to have those negative stories about people's past, but put them in perspective. And I do think, going back to the core question, you know, are we getting the wrong kind of people running? And we do create an environment where it's very hard to run. And, I would grant exceptions for any elected officials who control my budget who are still here. Many of those people just are not normal in the sense that they sacrifice or they live an unusual life or however you want to phrase it. But a lot gets put aside. And when they get to the level of running for president, these are people who are absolutely consumed with this pursuit. And they are very unusual. And I think there are risks with that. And there may be advantages. That work can turn into something constructive, but it can turn into something pretty destructive as well. And if we had a climate where more people felt like they could come forward, serve their community, serve their state, serve their country without sacrificing so much of their family life and their dignity in the process, more of those people would come forward, and we would probably get a little bit healthier mix than we have.
Panelists, let's have our concluding question be local news, because here we're local today. We're talking local issues in the legislative summit. Talk to me a little bit about the role of local news in the presidential candidates and in their destiny, in their future.
Well, you know, one of the things that we know is that people trust local news more than they trust national news. Maybe because it's close to home. I'm not sure, but they do. And we repeatedly find this. We also know that there isn't very much local news that's focused on national news, for obvious reasons. There are alternatives. Nevertheless, people are more likely to look at a local news outlet, TV, or the local paper. They may get a large percentage of what they know from that. And local news, you know, don't have big budgets. It isn't always the star reporters and the local small town newspaper. And so it's not necessarily very aggressive news reporting. And so that means it's pretty reactive. It's pretty dependent upon what's fed to it. It would be actually a great contribution to American life if local news, because people are trust and are going to read local news, provided more information about the issues. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen because local newspapers are shrinking like other newspapers. It's a real problem. But it would be a great asset to the nation.
And I'd love to see the diversity of coverage that would come from that. I think that's one of the things that we lose in that, you know, the national news organizations are national in their nature, and they tend to look at things at kind of this aggregate level where a lot of problems, like I think a lot of the problems in East Texas, just get lost in the mix. If there's not a certain level of crisis, it's not addressed. And I think if we had more local coverage, we'd see more focus, and if nothing else, a broader range of things, and questions coming from people who are more like us. I mean, I understand that media people are professionals, and that gives them a different orientation than me. But you know, in my opinion, if there's anything that's more out of touch than a national politician, it's a national reporter. I mean, these are people who sit in an air-conditioned studio all day and making millions and millions of dollars telling you who looks after them best. And I'm not willing to trust that. I think those people have a very particular point of view. I think those local reporters are more in touch with the kind of concerns that you and I have.
I think there may be a handful of people making millions and millions of dollars working for media outlets,
The
Katie Couric's of the world
yes.
But I think most media organizations have people on the street, on the beat, collecting information that are used by those folks. But I do think that local media can play a really important role by looking at what writing stories, broadcasting stories, what certain policies would mean for a certain area. For instance, healthcare. It touches everyone's lives. In Houston, it's a major industry. We should, you know, find those issues that we can relate the candidates' policies to our local audience and do that service. That's public service, and it's what we all should be doing.
I agree 100%. One of the things we've tried to do at KLTV in particular, we have access to the speeches. In other words, we get the White House emails. So if the president makes an appearance, we get the speech in its entirety. If the president does remarks in the Rose Garden, we get the speech in its entirety. If Romney does a major address, wherever, we get the speech in its entirety. And we put these on our websites, and we encourage people to read them. Unfiltered, without anyone telling you what he said, not going through the reporter's eyes, but letting you see directly what that candidate intended. We have struggled over the past couple of presidential campaigns with having to edit much of the national material that comes down that we would normally use on a couple of our newscasts. We can't just simply be a funnel any longer for what ABC and CNN wants to pour out into the marketplace. Because often, unfortunately, it is biased. And it does take a very, very strict position. So, what we try to do is to just cut it down to the truth without the opinion. Because we don't believe, if our viewers want that, they can go get it someplace else. But that's just one of the small things that we've tried to do as a local news station. I think the most important thing we can do is we put these speeches on as we carry some of these speeches live on our back channel for our viewers to see, or we stream them live on our website, is to give the viewers every opportunity to see for themselves without it going through the filter of a reporter or a commentator or a news anchor somewhere. And I think that's one of the most important things that we can do as a local station. That and Peggy is very, very important for us to identify every issue that these candidates talk about, the few that they do, specifically as they relate to our viewers and our news consumers and our communities.
So taking personal time, more time, to really dig into something and see for themselves point blank instead of having it spoon-fed to them.
Our success as a local station is to serve our community and to do everything we can to make our community more informed and a better place to live. So you're absolutely right. We that has got to be our primary goal. We've got to be relevant in the lives of the consumers we serve. I think that's the biggest mistake most of the national media have made, is that they're no longer relevant. They don't bring any meaning. Our responsibility is, in my humble opinion, is to make sure our viewers are informed to the best of our ability and to give them news and information that touches their minds, their hearts, their pocketbooks, their lives, their families, and their health. And if we can do that, we've succeeded.
Panelists, do you have anything else to add?
I'll just make a point that I think the market is driving local news outlets to pay more attention to local news and trying to relate things to their readers. There are so many outlets that people can go to on the internet, cable news. People don't want the Houston Chronicle to do the same story that the New York Times did or the Wall Street Journal did. They want that story about what the president's budget means for base closings in Texas, or what his health care plan might mean for everyone, you know, especially as it relates to the medical center. So I think that's what they're looking for us to do, and I think there's a recognition by our owners, and there's definitely been a shift in all of the newspapers in Texas toward more local news. You see it in the morning news as well.
I'd just like to say I am so much happier with my job security than local media people. I do not envy their position, because that's really getting squeezed in a lot of different directions. And I think also the coverage they can provide is heavily shaped by the audience. And to be honest, a lot of us have made up our minds about the elections. And so often they are playing to us because we want to see the polling numbers. We want to see if our person is ahead or behind. And that doesn't help those of you who are trying to make the choice. And sometimes, you know, we're responsible for where we push the coverage, and we need to step back and say, well, maybe I'd be looking at the issue still. I have a favorite candidate, but let's see the coverage on health care, because maybe I'm backing the wrong person, or maybe somebody down the street needs to hear this story, even though I'm too stubborn to reconsider.
This concludes the media roundtable discussion of the Lone Star Legislative Summit held February 16th on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. Thank you to the guests, Kenny Bowles, Dr. Ken Collier, Dr. George Edwards, and Patty Kilday Hart. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This has been a co-production of Red River Radio, Stephen F. Austin State University, and the Nacogdoches County Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, and good day from Nacogdoches, Texas.
You've been listening to a special roundtable discussion on the media's impact on the 2012 presidential race, recorded live at the Lone Star Legislative Summit on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. The Lone Star Legislative Summit was produced by the Nacogdoches County Chamber of Commerce in coordination with Stephen F. Austin State University and presented by Norbord. Kate Archer Kent, news producer for Red River Radio, served as our moderator tonight, and our panel featured Dr. George Edwards, University Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University, Dr. Ken Collier, an Associate Professor of Political Science at Stephen F. Austin State University, Kenny Bowles, the news director for KLTV and KTRE-TV in East Texas, and Patty Kilday Hart, Metro columnist for the Houston Chronicle. This broadcast was recorded by Sherry Williford with assistance from Pat Spence. Photos for our website provided by Kaylee Head and Bruce Partain. Broadcast coordination was provided by Ken Collier and Sherry Williford. The post-production engineer and producer for this broadcast was Bill Beckett. This has been a production of Red River Radio, a community-supported broadcast service of LSUS.